Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 14th of Iyar. Today we're going to do a response of two Pesach Frank, but the response is to Rav Avraham Yehuda Leib Zilberman, who has a Hebrew Wikipedia page. Rav Avraham Yehuda Leib Zilberman was born in 1889, and he passed away in 1947. This is going to be a tshuva from 1943. He was the chief rabbi of Tzfat for more than 30 years by 1947, which means it was in 1917 when he was 28 years old that he was appointed the chief rabbi of Tzfat. And the truth is it was younger than that when he was appointed a dayan in Tzfat, because he was born in Tzfat. His father was the head of the Ashkenazic Kehillah, and his grandfather was an important rav as well, Rav Rafael Zilberman, who was the Rav Rashi of the Ashkenazim in Tzfat until 1917, so I guess when his father's grandfather passed away. So he inherited the Rabbanut of Tzfat. He's a long-standing Tzfat family. He's a Talmud Chacham. He learned Torah. He went to Europe, went to Romania at his grandfather's behest to stay with the Hasidic Rebbe there. He was part of Rav Kook's Masah HaRabbanim that Rav Kook and Rav Zonenfeld, Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, went around to look at to tour the Moksha Avot and see in 1913. He's an important Rav in the pre-war state of Israel, and he's the head rabbi of Tzfat. He writes a letter, which is printed in Shut Har Tzvi Evan HaEzer Siman Kuf Vav, in response of 106 of Har Tzvi, of Tzvi Pesach Frank's Tshuvot, and the response is from the 14th of Iyar. But he, perhaps because he's such a Talmud Chacham, spends much of what we'll see here is the letter. He'll lay out many, many, many of the halachic issues, and then Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank will lay out a few of the others and tell him how he understands the case. So the case is, there's a widow. Many of these stories, there's a tragedy underlying it. And here, too, there's a tragedy underlying all of this. And I will comment on it a little bit just because it jumps out at you. There's a widow, which is already sad. And she decided that of what her husband left behind, of the estate that her husband left behind, she decided to donate some of it to charity. So this is the way it goes. He writes to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and he says he's the Rav of Beis Din of Tzfat, this Rav Avraham Leib Zilberman. He's writing to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who's the Gaon of Beis Din of Yerushalayim, and is about 15 years older than him, so he's a more advanced Torah scholar in that sense. And he writes, Lahodieni Chavat Da'ato Da'at Torah, or Chavas Da'ito Da'is Torah, if that's the way they would say it. But I noticed it just because it's come up a lot, and I usually leave out the introductions to these letters because I'm interested in the substance, and they can get very flowery. But in this case, I think it jumped out at me because it's a reminder that, and this was true for letters written to Rav Uziel, to this, and people wrote about themselves too. When people wrote that I'm going to express my opinion Da'at Torah, it can later be taken to extreme lengths, but we shouldn't forget that it was for a long time just a common phrase, and all it meant was my best understanding, my best assumptions about what the Torah wants in the situation. So it wasn't when Rav Uziel, for example, write, I am writing you now my Chavas Da'at Torah, it doesn't mean that I'm the only authority, because Rav Uziel in particular is the one who's prone to saying at the end of a letter, that's what I think, but don't act on it until you get the agreement of two or three other people. So it's a reminder that the phrase Chavat Da'ato Da'at Torah meant something. It meant, I want your Torah opinion. I want your opinion, your expression of your understanding of what is the Torah that wants, but it never meant to be exclusive. It never meant to be authoritative in that sense of leaving out all other possibilities. Back to the widow. She gave to give to poor people, and she gives the money she appoints the person to give out the money to the poor people, her husband's, her late husband's brother. So at this point, it would sound like the late husband, the brother, is somebody's trust. She gives it to her brother-in-law. She says, I want to give money to the poor people. She gives it to her brother-in-law. Now, she had had one daughter who was married, but that daughter, sadly, after this happened at some point, passed away without children. And the reason that's important is because now it means the husband has no descendants. Let's remember, halachically, by Torah law, and by the way, it was Sun Chazal, and in the absence of any kind of a halachic will that would change these things, the wife doesn't inherit her husband. Part of what the ketubah was about, today it's all complicated thing because we don't write ketubot, Ashkenazim at least, don't write ketubot that actually lay out real financial responsibility. We just use a form. So that just using the form sort of blurs the idea that the ketubah was supposed to be what we in America today would call a prenuptial agreement. A financial prenuptial agreement. It would be a laying out of exactly what would happen should the marriage go wrong in either of two ways. If they got divorced or if the husband passes away, it was supposed to lay out what the wife would get. So the whole discussion in the Gemara after her husband passes away, because one of the tna'im of the ketubah was that she was allowed, as long as she stayed in Almanah, meaning didn't marry anybody else, she was allowed to live off the estate and get fed and supported by the estate. Then you get to all sorts of, they can be tense situations in the Gemara if the husband has heirs who are not her children, or even who are her children, but they don't want to treat her the proper way. So what rights does she have, what rights do they have? That can get complicated. In our case, that's not the situation here. But the reason I bring it up is because it makes it clear that the wife is not, in the absence of a halachic will that would make her an heir, an heiress. In halacha, she's not an heiress. She has control over the state of husband passes away very often, especially because she hasn't collected her ketubah yet, but she's not an heiress. So when she passes away, I'm sorry, when the daughter passes away without children, then all of a sudden, the wife is now in a situation where she's sitting on an estate of her husband's, and the heir now is this brother-in-law. So I would have hoped that this brother-in-law and the widow have a good enough relationship. She seems to trust him with her tzedakah money, that they would work this all out. That's not what happens. The brother-in-law now says that all the money that she got from her husband's estate that was theoretically going to the daughter, because she was the only child they had, now really belonged to him. And then he says, so when she tried to give money to tzedakah and there was a daughter alive, I didn't say anything because the daughter is the heiress. But now that she's passed away, this daughter, sadly, and now I'm the heir, I don't want all that money to go to the poor people. I think it's my Yerusha at a Torah level. So I don't know this brother-in-law. Maybe he was in such dire straits and the widow should have really been helping him out and she didn't bother. I don't know we don't know those stories. But imagine, you have a family, the husband passes away, then after the husband passes away, the daughter passes away, and there's this widow here. If somebody is going to point out, we don't know if the widow's still living or not when the brother-in-law is doing this, but the brother-in-law is just saying, oh, and all that money you gave to Stucka that you thought was going to go to poor people, I want to keep it now because I'm the Yorish and I don't want it going to poor people. And now the son-in-law of this widow, he's saying, no, it should be mine because my wife inherited in her lifetime. And when she passes away, I inherit her, because in halacha it is true, again, in the absence of halachic will, that a husband does inherit from his wife. So they're now both claiming that the money should go to them. So it's a brach, right? It's a tear. I don't know why that word is sticking in my head recently, but it's just a mess. And they both agree. So there's I'm going to refer to them as the son-in-law and the brother-in-law, as if the widow is the center of the action. So the brother-in-law and son-in-law agree that this daughter never knew her mother had given the gift to the poor. And that'll be important because it'll be a question of whether or not we think that she agreed, because if she was the heiress while she was alive and she agreed, that would then ratify it as a gift and the gift would go through, maybe. So this Rav Yudaleib Zilberman says also, since the person who passed away, the man who passed away, left the whole estate in the control of his wife, of the widow, and she could have used it on whatever she could have used it, right? And she didn't want to give it to her daughter in her lifetime. So then it doesn't seem like it's any worse than a milveh, than a loan for the son-in-law. Meaning, the son-in-law says, well, he should be Yorishit, but Reverend Yudaleib Zilberman says, it seems to him from seeing in Evan Ezer that we think that husbands only inherit actual property that's already come in, or actual assets that have already come into possession. It's called Yorish Bimuchzak, in what she's already in possession of. But what's Roi, what should be coming to her, so that would be even things that we would today talk about as being hers, let's say, you know, accounts receivable, I think is the accounting term, right? Things that are owed to you, but they haven't come to you yet. So they're supposed to come to you. You might have argued, well, it's already mine. So in accounting, you're not allowed to assume it's already yours because you don't always collect accounts receivable, I think that's right. If it's not and you're listening, so please email me, grothst@gmail.com, and let me know what the right term is. But I think that's right. So the point is, if it's only out there and supposed to come, then there are certain areas where it doesn't count as already being yours in halacha. One of them is this case. Another one is, for example, a bechor, firstborn, who's supposed to get a double portion as compared to his brothers in an estate if there was no halachic will changing that. So he doesn't get that about roi k'muchzak, meaning if the father had loans outstanding and the loans then later come in or paid off, so the bechor would share equally with his brothers on those things because he doesn't get a double portion in roi k'muchzak. Here too, this idea of roi k'muchzak applies to this daughter who passed away, that when we say that the husband, really the son-in-law, inherits from his deceased wife, he only inherits what's muhsak, but the estate wasn't muhsak, wasn't in her daughter, the daughter's possession, it was in the widow mother's possession, and therefore he doesn't really have a claim to it. So therefore, Rabbi Zilverman says that he should be out of the picture. But if it's true, if they agree that the daughter never knew that the mother gave the gift to the poor, or she knew, but she only stayed silent, so that's going to be another whole topic in halacha. When somebody stays silent, what does that signal in halacha? So very often we say, that when somebody stays silent, that's an indication that they agree or they're not, that they are agreeing, that they're accepting whatever's going on. So if the daughter had known and stayed silent, then you might say she's sort of agreeing by her silence that her mother should do this, even though it was at the time her inheritance was supposed to come her way. Because remember, halakhically, even if the widow is left in charge of the estate, that doesn't mean it's her estate. It just means that she has the right to use it until such time as they settle the issues, either with a ketubah or she lives off the estate for long enough, and then that heir can say, we don't want you living off the estate anymore, or something goes on. But it's never hers in the sense of she's inherited. It's always the daughter. So if she gives away a gift and the daughter is silent, if that's agreement, then it certainly should be okay. But what if it's not agreement? So that would show, if she was only silent and didn't agree, explicitly agree, that would say, says the Rav Avraham Yudel Leib Zilverman, that the brother-in-law, meaning the brother-in-law, the deceased father, husband of the widow's brother, has not lost his rights as an heir, because it wasn't given away with the agreement of the heirs, as it says in Ebenezer, and therefore. In Ebenezer, there's an explicit thing that says that if an heir sees that somebody sold something and stayed quiet, that is not an abandoning of one's rights to it. It's just you stayed quiet because you didn't have the ability to oppose it or something like that. But it doesn't signal agreement, acceptance, or assent. Then he suggests, even if she had explicitly agreed, the daughter, and then passed away, he thinks that maybe you could argue that when the Shulchan Aruch paskins that if she explicitly agreed that you can't go back on it, that's only if she's still alive. But if she passes away, then it might be like another situation which is called a noder umate. A noder umate means somebody takes an oath to do something positive with their money. Let's say give it to the tzedakah or something like that. Halacha is that the yarshim are not mechuyavim likayim. They're not required to fulfill that oath necessarily. So that's a whole topic of its own we're not getting into here, but the Ksosa Choshen had Ksosity quotes, and here too. So if the mother gives it to the poor, she didn't give it, dedicates it to the poor, and the daughter, even if she were to have said, yes, I agree, that's a good idea. So there is in Hekdesh, in giving things to sanctified purposes, particularly Beit HaMikdash, and to things like the upkeep of the Beit HaMikdash or korbanot or sacrifices, there is a concept called amiratel legavoa kemesiratel lehedyot, that when you say you're going to give it, that would be like you actually gave it to in a regular transaction, meaning that the hold of Hekdesh, the hold of the Beit HaMikdash on assets is so much stronger than ordinary human assets that even just the announced intention to donate something to Hekdesh, l'amirato, is already like it's given. So if you said that about the poor people, then even though it's in the possession of this brother-in-law, you could say, but when you said you were going to give it to the poor, it becomes the property of the poor. Once it becomes property of the poor, then you would seem not to be able to go back on it. But the Nesivos disagrees, and he thinks, no, when you say it's being given to tzedakah, the Ksos said it's not like that with giving to tzedakah. The Nesivos says it is like that with giving to tzedakah, and then Rav Avraham Yudel Leib Zilverman points out that Machan Ephraim says that it's a machlokot rishonim. So that would seem like we have that problem, that issue, because there would be a set of Rishonim who think that the gift wasn't already given to the poor. If it's not already given to the poor, then even if the daughter had explicitly agreed that it should go to the poor, it would be a case of Nadra Umeita, that she had agreed to something, she made a commitment to something, but then she passed away, where the heirs are not required to fulfill what she had said. But again, I don't want to harp too much on the family relationship aspect of it, but again, it would mean then, now again, maybe the brother-in-law has really just got into some huge financial problem, and that's why he's got to get this money, and that's why he's so desperate, but it would mean that he's got a sister-in-law wanting to give money to the poor, for all I know, in memory of her dead husband, whatever, she wants to give money to the poor from the estate, and the daughter-in-law, his niece had thought that was a good idea. Explicitly, we're suggesting now. And now he's claiming that she didn't ever know about it. So if she didn't ever know about it, then there was no agreement, obviously. But Rabbi Avraham Yehuda Leib Zilber is trying to say, even if she knew about it and she explicitly agreed, maybe there he also wouldn't have to follow through on it. But imagine what pressure it would take on him for him to have to say to himself, yes, I know, my sister-in-law, and we're going to talk about the sister-in-law in a second, and my deceased niece wanted to give tzedakah, and I'm going to keep the money for myself. Now, you might think also that when she gave the money to him, then the widow gave the money to the brother-in-law, that might count as a giving it. So it's not just she said she was going to give it to the poor. You could say, when we say that Amiratullah Gavoa Kibsiratullah Hedyot, that saying you're going to give it to Hektesh is like already giving it to in a regular transaction, that doesn't apply to tzedakah, even if we're going to follow the Ketzos to say it doesn't apply to tzedakah. You might have argued, though, but she gave it to him and she made him a messenger. Now, sometimes in halacha, if I give something to somebody else, that's an act of giving it already, and then it's already like it's fully given. If we were to apply that here, then when she gave it to him and said, give it to the poor, it would already be like, it wouldn't be just amirato legavoa, it would be like a mesira, it would be like a giving over to the poor. But says Rav Avraham Leib Zilberman, the Tumim says it's not true. That when we say, when somebody says tnu l'aniyim and gives them the money, it's not kizachi dami, meaning if the widow had given it to the brother-in-law and said to him at the time she gave it to him, I want you to acquire this for the poor, and then you will later, you know, hand it out, distribute it to whichever poor come along. If she had said that, so that can happen, and that would be like a real zichia, a real acquisition, because in halacha, we think zachin adam shelo b'fanav, that you can acquire things, people can acquire things for other people, even if they're not around. Why do we think that? Because it's a zchut to them. So we think if it's something that's coming their way that they're going to be happy about, that's the principle, that other people can acquire it for them as well. So when she says give it, when she says to her husband, to her brother-in-law, give, and remember, notice the level of trust she had for this brother-in-law, who's not trying to take the money for himself. She had in mind, if we had said that tenu, give it, is like zachi, is like acquire it for them, we wouldn't have a question because it's already been acquired for the poor. But the Tumim holds that tenu, it doesn't count as zachi. Then it so thinks it becomes like an obligation, like a financial obligation, a loan. So even with a loan, the shock held, we don't say ten kazachi, meaning if you hold that, we're all obligated, or at least this widow was obligated to give money to the poor, and it's like we have an outstanding loan on us all the time that the poor, now, each specific poor person can't collect it from us because we can say they're other poor, but the idea that we have to give money to the poor is an outstanding loan upon all of us at all times, if you hold that way, which the Ketzos apparently did, says Rav Yehuda Leib Zilberman. So then you might say it's like an obligation. So if I have an obligation to somebody and I give over the money, nonetheless, Shach says, even there, we don't say tein kizachi unless you give it to that actual person, I think, to whom you owe it. And then there are other inheritance issues that come up that he points out. So she's got an inheritance in her hands, and we are assuming that the husband left in her hands to use as she wishes while she's alive. But Nebuchadnezzar, the halacha is, unless she says, look, my husband left this for me and meant it for go to me, then any rise in value in the estate, let's say he leaves her, you know, $1,000, and she uses the $1,000 well, and she grows it into $10,000. And she says, I made a good profit, but the Shulchan Aruch seems to assume that since it's not her estate, unless she says the words, my husband left me this money as an estate of my own, he gave it to me, it's not the estate, then the shvach goes to the yotomim, the rise in value. So let's not assume that she invested it. You could argue that she can get a salary, whatever it is. Let's say it was just a wine seller that had it in it, 20 bottles of wine that were worth $1,000. 20 bottles of wine could easily be worth $1,000, no? 20, yeah, $1,000, and then the wine went up in value, now it's worth $5,000. She could say, well, that should come to me because it was in my possession when it went up in value. We hold that no, that unless she had made the claim that it's her estate, not just that she has the right to use it, then the shvach goes to the yitomim. And the reason why that's valuable for us to know, it would mean that all the property in her hand, we assume, is really owned by, is in the chezkat ha-yorshim. It's in the possession of the yorshim halachically, and that'll be relevant to this question of, when she tries to give the money, to whom does it really belong, and who really has the rights over it, and things like that. Now, coming back to the possibility that she gave it in front of the daughter, she would have given it to the, that if the daughter had stayed silent, that doesn't count as an assent. So he says, you know, however, there is a Mordechai, that a woman who says, a widow, who says, or a woman, I think a widow, who says in front of her son, who's supposed to be the heir, give such and such money to my relative, and the son doesn't say anything, it doesn't count as nishba'al ketubata. Nishba'al ketubata is before a woman can collect her ketubah, she has to make take certain oaths, and then her rights to the estate other than her ketubah have ended. So you might think that since she's giving out money, it means she's like she's saying, I'm taking my ketubah money now, and therefore my connection and my right to be supported by the estate ends. So we say, no, it's not true, because it's shtikato kohoda. We treat his silence as assent, and since we treat his silence as assent, then it's not like she's doing something against his will, anything like that. Now the Taz in Evan Ezer says that all this only applies where the estate is small enough that the only thing that the son will have the right to is an oath, meaning the estate is only barely covers her ketubah, or just covers her ketubah. So then if she's going to collect her ketubah, she's just to make an oath that she doesn't have any money anywhere else that her husband had left for her, and then the son gets nothing. So in that case, we can say he was mochel the shvua, he gave up on the shvua. But if the money itself wasn't hers, so then you wouldn't be able to claim that, because he'd just be silent about this money, but there's lots of other money that he's still waiting for. However, that case turns out in those cases in Eben Ezra, they're not relevant here, says this Rabbi Yudoli Zilberman, because the estate is actually much greater than the value of the ketubah, which to me would imply that, I tried to say maybe the brother-in-law was in such financial straits, but here, since it would seem like he's going to get the whole rest of the estate, let alone this money for the poor, so that takes away one of the claims that I had made. In any case, so skipping a few last points that he makes, he thinks that it's true that the Yoresh, this brother-in-law, is correct. But now, this review that we had should make it clear that Rav Yudoli Zilberman is a perfectly solid, competent, and knowledgeable Torah scholar in his own right. And he is not only knowledgeable in general, he's knowledgeable, it seems like, on the issues that are relevant to this case. And he knows Rishonim and Achronim and Shulchan Aruch with Achronim on their discussions of this case. He's like really seems to be involved in the Inyanim, in the issues. And yet he feels the need to turn to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. And he says here, it's because Nogela Hekdesh Aniyim, there's the poor people involved, there's money that would have gone to the poor, and therefore I'm writing to you to please take out of your time to tell me what you think about this, any signs of this. So the Rabbi Yosef Frank writes back on the 14th of Iyar of Tufshin Gimel of 1943. He says, I got your letter, and you know, you wrote well, and you caught up on the issues, but you didn't give me the facts of the case well enough, which is so interesting to point out, right? You can know all the halachos, but the facts of the case are vital because you need to know how to apply them. So, for example, he says, I don't know if the widow's still alive, which is really an interesting point because there's nothing in the letter that says whether she's alive or not. It sounds like the brother-in-law is making a claim. It's unclear if she's alive. So if this widow is still alive, then the family dynamics is even more complicated. Can you imagine that the widow's still alive, her daughter passes away, and all of a sudden, you know, the $1,000 she thought she gave to the poor, or the $1,000,000 she thought they gave to the poor, her brother-in-law is trying to say, no, it should go to me. So I think it happens all the time. Not all the time, I hope, but it happens often, and it's such a sad thing to watch people lose sight of these family connections and of their connections to each other, and again, to let the brother-in-law off the hook a little bit. We don't know the financial pressure that he was under. And therefore, he says, if she's alive, ask her. This money that she was giving, is it money that her husband had given to her, or is it from the estate? According to the way that the letter writes, the central figure who had the original money when he left her an estate, he left her something in a will, so I don't know what that means. Is it clear that he meant she could do with it whatever she wanted for as long as she's alive? Right, you can do that. So, or that would be one option, so then she could. Or let's say also she might have brought in what's called a nedunya. So a nedunya is often called a dowry, which isn't done so much anymore. But halachically, if you're going to follow the strict halacha, again, if you're not going to follow the strict halacha on these financial issues, then the brother-in-law should be giving the money to tzedakah just because his sister-in-law told him to and they agreed to and he committed to it. So he's trying to say, no, I can go back and find the strict halacha. So if you're going to go back to the strict halacha, the truth is if she brought property into the marriage, she has the right to claim that property. Also, what's the value of the ketubah? Because then maybe she could claim I was using my ketubah money. And then, so all of those would be reasons why the brother-in-law could not deny her the right to give that money to tzedakah. Also, he says, you didn't tell me what was the relationship between the widow and the daughter while this daughter was alive after her father passed away. Right? So, many times, there's perfectly good relationships. It's a mother and a daughter, and they're happy with each other, and they get along, and everything's great, and that's what we hope for. And that's what Stephen Schulberg says. If they're living in one city and they would meet regularly, you know, they would go out for coffee, they would have her over for Shabbos meals, and there was just a family relationship with love and a brotherly spirit, right? Achva, not really brotherly spirit, a fraternal and a maternal daughter spirit, all the right things you want out of a relationship. And it's been a few years between the passing of the father and the passing of the daughter. Right? So you didn't tell me that. And that would be important. Why? Because then, if they're having a good relationship, and the daughter, even if the daughter doesn't know about the gift, we might then be able to assume that she, of course, would have said yes. Meaning, let's use big numbers, because we know that there's a big estate now. Let's say the husband had left $10 million, and it's supposed to eventually go to the daughter. And the mother spent $10,000 here and $20,000 there and $50,000 there on this and this and this, and she's spending it, and the daughter and she are just getting along fine, because the daughter has plenty of money too, let's say, and they're getting along fine. Then the fact that she asked the brother-in-law to give $50,000 to tzedakah, you'd have every reason to assume that the daughter would have agreed. And then once the daughter would have agreed at the time, if she agreed explicitly at the time, then you would think that that would change the halacha. And that's what Rabbi Frank says. But even though I don't have all these details, I want to share a couple of thoughts with you about this issue. If she didn't know about the hektage, if she did know about the hektage, she stayed quiet. Rav Avraham Yudel Zilberman said, that's a shtika, it's not a hodah. So he says, well, that whole question is, there's lots of situations where we think it is a hodah, and there's situations where we think it's not a hodah. And one of the standards you see in a Ramah is that if you have no power over the situation, so then we think that your silence is not a hodah, because, I'm sorry, if the person making the claim, of some claim, has no power over the situation, then we think that shtika doesn't mean anything, because you just didn't bother saying anything, because it doesn't matter. But here, where the mother has the money, so there it would seem like a shtika would be a hodah, because she knows it's going to happen. So if she thinks it shouldn't happen, she should speak up. So that's an important general question about when is silence okay? When do halakhically we have the right to stay silent and think that we're not forfeiting certain rights of ours by staying silent? Which is a problem to saying, though. If the mother says, I'm giving $50,000 to tzedakah, if the daughter knew about it, in this case, everybody agrees the daughter didn't know about it, but if the daughter knew about it, then she should have spoken up if she mattered to her, because it was going to go to tzedakah. But the daughter doesn't know she's going to die, so the daughter should have spoken up. So there, it would seem like her shtika would count as a hoda'ah. Once it counts as a hoda'ah, then it would seem like the sale, that like the gift has been given already. Parallel example, he says, and Sivos points out, if somebody says to a guy, let's say I say to somebody, I'm going to buy this from you for $2, and I'm taking it now, and I do it, and the guy stays silent, that's like a hodah, that's an agreement. Why? Because I'm taking it, so if you cared, you should have spoken up then. That can get complicated, whatever. That can get complicated too, but that's what he says, and Sivos says the same thing would be true here. If you hear that your mother's giving money to tzedakah, and she's about to do it, and you don't speak up, that would seem to be like it's assent, it's agreement to it going on. Then there's another case that he quotes from Shvut Yaakov, where the Shvut Yaakov points out that the Gemara has a case. So let's say two people walk into a court, and they're holding on to something, both of them, and they're both claiming it, and one of them grabs it from the other one, the other one doesn't say anything. So unless the other one can give a reason why he didn't say anything, that not saying anything is like hodah, so the grabbing of it. So too, another case, in the Shvut Yaakov was that two people had left something with a third party to watch over it for them and said, don't give it to either one of us unless we both agree. And then they came back, the two of them together, and one of them said, give it to me. And the other one didn't say anything. So the other one is now claiming, my silence didn't mean anything, I just didn't say anything, and because I thought that the guy would know to rely on your earlier instruction. So the guy says, no, because he's grabbing in front of you, and he's grabbing in front of you, you got to speak up. So an important point about when we do it and don't have to speak up, and when we forfeit certain rights by not speaking up. And on the other hand, the Talmud says if the person who's doing the talking is talking about stuff that the other one has no relevance to, he's doing something about his own things, so then he doesn't speak up and it doesn't count as agreeing to it. You know, let's say, you know, Joe does something wrong with Joe's own money, and Jack doesn't speak up. Jack is not in any way implicated in that because he doesn't have to speak up because it doesn't affect him. It's not part of what's going on with him. Maybe it's better if he spoke up, but it's not considered hoda'ah in whatever halakhic context. Hoda'ah would be an issue. So here too, if the daughter knew about it, it would certainly require her to speak up when she was alive, because if she objected to it, because it's happening. So certainly if she hadn't spoken up, that would have counted as agreement. But that's not the case here. But here the case is that she's passed away, and then the claim was, well, now the heirs don't have to keep the neder, the promise of the person who left it to them. So Rav Tzimichus says, I don't think that's the way we paskin, actually. That I think we paskin, he says, like the Chatam Sofer and Chavshin Mishpat, Simon Kuf Yudal and Kuf Tedvav, who held it as being obvious that, in fact, heirs are required to fulfill the oaths of the one who bequeathed it to them. And the only situation where we say they don't have to keep it up is where you don't know exactly what the obligation was, so then there's a debate. But when it's clear what the hekdesh was, what the person meant to donate, then we think that heirs, in fact, are required to pay it out. Not only that, the mother, the widow, if she was around, would have been believed, and if she is around, is believed to say that her daughter said to her, you know what, you keep it all. You know, this is what you have to keep you alive for the rest of your life. You keep it, and anansade, we see she left it with her. She didn't like immediately come in and say, I'm going to watch over what you're spending. This, she left it with her. So that is a chazaka that establishes a presumption that she is sort of in charge of the whole estate. And we have a good reason to assume that she really had conceded it all to her, which would leave the mother with the right to give tzedakah as she wanted. And then the whole claim that the daughter hadn't agreed, therefore it's still part of the estate and the inheritance, wouldn't be true anymore. That would be especially true, says Rabbi Frank, if the daughter knows that she's passing away, she knows her life is limited. For sure, we would assume that she would prefer her mother get it than anybody else because her mother's closer to her, so that she would have given it to her as a gift. If she did that, then the estate really is the mother's. There's no such thing as he's now the heir on a d'oraita level. He may eventually get the money somehow, although if it's really the mother's, if it's really the widow's, then her heirs would now step into the picture. But for sure, the money she gave to the poor should be continuing to give it to the poor. And even if the daughter didn't, and even if the daughter would come to mother and say, you know, I want the money in my estate, that would have been a whole complicated thing. It's not clear that she could have gotten it out, because you would have to check the value of the ketubah and the agreements and what the husband did and didn't do, and all those things would have gotten into play. And therefore, if Tzipras Frank thinks that, no, we think that the money should probably go to the poor, that's what he thinks we have to do, and if at least you should find a compromise between them that, and he suggests what the compromise is, that let the poor take 2/3 of the money and let whoever's the representative of the poor concede that he can keep the other, the brother can keep the brother-in-law can keep the other third, and you'll work it out. So he says, I already wrote this all very quickly, and that's what I think. So that's what Rabbi Frank and Rav Avi Yehuda Leib Zilberman teaching us a lot about inheritance issues, about silence and when you have to speak up issues, about how money is apportioned and not apportioned, about who has what rights over what monies, a responsible day for the 14th of Iyar. With thanks to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Brown, and David Hakhauser for putting the Shiurim online and letting us all share Torah with each other. Have a great day.